thatcoversme.com, and I want to welcome you to the By Faith podcast, where each week this season I'm talking to someone who is walking forward by faith, many through difficult circumstances. We're asking the question, how does God meet us in our deepest, darkest pain, and how does he turn that pain into beauty? This is the theme of my new book, Searching for Spring, which releases today. Yes, that's right, today. So before we get to my conversation with my guest today, I want to tell you a little more about the book. And what do I mean when I say searching for spring? Well, when we look around at our world, and if we dare, into our own hearts, we can so easily despair at what we find. Broken relationships, difficult obstacles, and excruciating pain. So when we read verses like Ecclesiastes 3:11, which says, God makes everything beautiful in its time, we wonder how and when this will come true. Can God truly make all things beautiful? And if so, can he do it in our lives? These are the big picture questions we all at some point ask. The idea for this book was birthed out of conversations I had with a friend about her own difficult circumstances. Her questions and doubts forced me to try on my beliefs, so to speak, about God and his character within her trial and find out if they held up. I needed to know what true hope I could offer her and in turn myself. I discovered that this life is a type of winter. There are some things that will remain unfixed for a time. One is what we've known all along. In this world, we will have trouble. Even though we know this, and even though these are Jesus' words, we don't want to accept them. We have trouble acknowledging we can't and won't avoid the harsh cold in this world and within our own hearts. And so searching for spring is really an analogy I use for our search for God's redemptive work, where suffering and death in us become fruitful life. Using Ecclesiastes 3 and the changing seasons as a framework, I invite readers like you to join me in my own treasure hunt for beauty in both familiar and unexpected places. I wrote this book for my friend and for everyone else who is in the midst of suffering, who finds their faith withering, or who is questioning whether God is at work or even present as they wait for something in their lives to become beautiful. You can find out more about the book on my website, gracecoversme.com, and just look for Searching for Spring under the Books tab. My guest today knows exactly what searching for spring looks like. His name is Sean Groves. Sean is a musician and Bible teacher who travels and speaks all over the world for Compassion International, which you'll hear more about in our conversation. Sean has also battled with debilitating depression, which he spoke so openly and honestly about with me, and will be so helpful to anyone listening, whether you deal with depression yourself or are a friend to someone who does. So friends, here's my conversation with Sean. Well, hey, Sean, I'm glad you're here with me today.
It's good to be here. With an extra large cup of coffee.
Yeah. Are you in Nashville today or are you traveling?
I am. We're having yet another snow day here. You guys have that?
Yeah. I saw on Instagram my friends in Nashville. It's like 4 days in a row or something.
Yeah, this is day three. We are officially out of activities from the boredom box. So I don't know what's going to happen.
How old are your kids now?
17. We just had some birthdays. 17, 15, 12, and 10.
Oh, my goodness. And y'all homeschool, right? Or no?
Well, so our oldest three, I guess you technically call it homeschool, but they go to a 2-day-a-week university-style tutorial thing. Yeah. But at their ages, they're really self-guided when they're at home. I mean, we don't really teach them much at home, honestly. They're above my abilities.
Is your 17-year-old a senior then?
She is a junior.
Junior, okay. Mm-hmm. So you got a little more time.
She's applying to colleges and writing scholarship essays and all of that.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Well, it's great to talk to you because little known fact to everyone listening is we already have known each other for years and years. We went to high school together.
Oh my gosh. We've probably known each other 30 years, something like that.
Maybe so.
A long time. Middle school?
Did we go to the same middle school? I don't even remember. I mainly remember you from high school.
Yeah, well, I knew you as my best friend's sister's best friend.
Yes. So our best
best friends. We're brother and sister. Our right. brother and sister.
Are. Yes, they continue to be related yes. all these years later.
So I want to tell how I remember you
in high school. Great.
And you tell, then you can tell how you remember me.
Okay.
So I remember you as always having a saxophone in your hand. We were in marching band together. And you're 2 years older than me in school, but we went to church together. We were in band together. So we were around each other a lot. And mm-hmm. you, yeah. that saxophone, that's how I remember you. And you would play it in church. You'd play like hymns, your alto sax, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I pulled the sax out a few weeks ago. I was just cleaning out my closet in my office and I saw it and I pulled it out and started playing. And all my kids came running in the office. Like, what is that? They had no idea I even played a saxophone, let alone what? Like, you know. Oh, yeah. So they had no idea. I just don't ever do that. I haven't done that in years and years and years.
I mean, that was your thing. You were really good. That's why it was your thing, because you were really good at it.
I don't know. I worked really hard at it. It was really the first – I guess we all kind of struggle with that as teenagers, going, what is my thing? Yeah. I mean, I have a kid right now who's struggling with that. What is my thing? What is the thing I do that – other people, you know, what I do well, most people know well. And that was my thing. Yeah, you're right. Totally was. But yeah, I moved from that to, I quickly discovered that saxophone did not impress girls like playing the piano did. So I quickly moved to piano and then, of course, guitar in college. So
you're just a musical person because you just seem to pick it up. Easily.
I used to be. I don't really do much music even these days. Isn't that weird? Yes, that's funny because I run into people who knew me from college or high school or middle school, and that's kind of how they think of me. But I don't do a lot of that anymore.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. It was fun while it lasted, but.
Okay, your turn. You tell how you remember me.
Well, it's funny because last night at dinner, we were just talking through our days. So what do you have going on tomorrow? What do you have? Oh, it's a snow day. Great. What are you going to do? Cause I'm going to be busy. I'm going to be doing this interview with this friend of mine from high school. And so I was telling my kids about you. We went to prom together.
Yeah.
And so they're looking at my wife going, is this okay with you? It's like, oh, I love Christine. And so I was telling them what you were like. Like you always seemed very now, of course, women are more mature than guys in general. I definitely see this now that I have teenage kids, how much more mature my girls are than my boys. But you and your circle of friends just seemed much more anchored, like stable, not a lot of drama.
That's true. We didn't have a lot of drama.
No, there was not a lot of drama. Really good friends, good listeners. Just as a group, you guys were the stable, mature people, you know, that you guys, I don't know a better way to describe it.
That is like, funny. I would have not thought of myself that way.
There's just a lot of, maybe that sticks out to me now because I have a 17-year-old daughter. And in teenage girl world, there's far more drama than I ever realized.
Yeah.
But you guys were the nice girls. There wasn't drama. There wasn't all that stuff going on.
Yeah.
And easy to talk to. You were always a very easy person to talk to. Yeah. So this is comfortable. It's no surprise to me that you go on and study counseling and be a good listener of people. You always had that quality, that ability. And your parents were a huge influence in my life as well.
Oh,
you know, I really decided to do music professionally after having a retreat at your parents' house.
Really?
In the bonus room of your house is where I made that decision.
Wow.
And they were just, your dad was hilarious. Was just a good example to me of a joyful, godly man.
Yeah.
I certainly knew godly men who were very serious.
Yeah. That's my dad.
But your dad's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And your mom's very encouraging, sweet. A second set of parents for a lot of us.
That's so sweet. They're going to be encouraged by hearing that. Well, I definitely remember the prom, and the picture in my head of the dress I was wearing is so awful. I looked like a I looked like a fish with shoulder pads.
I showed it actually last night, and they thought that your dress was gorgeous.
Oh, Oh my gosh. Well, maybe it's coming back in style after so many years. It is awful. It had those little, what are those? They're these huge scales.
They're sort of like sequins. Yeah, they're sort of sequins, but like, and they were like pink or salmon-y colored. I don't.
Oh my. Okay, well, we've grown up since then. Let's talk about now, because your life has changed a lot since your saxophone playing days. So I want to hear about, so you mentioned music in college, went to Baylor, and you studied music, and you became this musician that you probably did. I don't know if you saw that coming, but you had such success with music, and you were on the radio, and you won. Didn't you win awards for your first album? I mean, you had such immediate success with that.
I didn't see that coming. My commitment I made was, you know, I'd like to move to Nashville and give music a shot, but it was very open-ended. I'd like to go and study music in college. I'd like to go to Nashville and get any job I could in music. And I was as open as, I remember saying at that retreat, if that means sweeping the floor at a studio, getting coffee for a producer, or maybe someday my dream was maybe I could even write songs on the side. But I thought I might be a college pastor or teach saxophone private lessons, do something to pay the bills and write songs on the side. But I didn't expect to end up with a record deal. And I didn't expect that to lead me one day out of music to what I do now.
Yeah. So tell me about what you do now. You work for Compassion. What does that mean? What do you do for Compassion International?
Yeah, I'm technically not an employee. These days I go and speak at colleges and churches, a lot of women's conferences, large concert tours. And I just speak on behalf of Compassion. I do a lot of preaching at churches. Mostly in the U.S., but I'm in Canada about once a month also doing that. And all that happened because I was an artist, and I quickly just felt like there was more. Not that what I was doing was bad, that it was good, but that there was something great out there for me. And I got invited to go on a trip with Compassion and see the work that they do. I was really skeptical. I'd worked for a children's ministry when I was in college, and they weren't everything that they said they were. And so I just walked away from that experience thinking, I don't know that I want to be a part of a nonprofit that serves kids. It seems like that's too easily becomes a profit maker at the expense of children. And so I wasn't that interested, but really just cause I had a friend that worked for Compassion, I just indulged her and said, okay, I'll go see what you do. Yeah. It radically changed my worldview. After just 2 days in El Salvador, seeing what they were doing, I just was so convinced that what they were doing was biblical, that I had something to lend to that, that I could be really helpful to them. I could be a big mouth for them.
Yeah.
And it was just at a stage where I was really tired of talking about me and selling me.
Yeah.
And I needed a break from that and needed to be about something bigger than me. And so it was great. I continued to be an artist, but speak for them at my concerts. And that slowly evolved over the years into me not really even bringing my guitar along and me just speaking at different events. So that's what I do these days.
And tell, for people who don't know what Compassion is, can you explain what they do?
Yeah, so Compassion International, they invented child sponsorship in 1952. Today, they're still the highest rated child sponsorship organization of their kind. And that kind is they work through the local church. So they believe in the power of the local church. They believe that that's the prescribed solution to poverty in Scripture, that we're to work through the church. So that we are not able to not only meet physical needs, but spiritual needs as well. So Compassion meets the physical and spiritual needs of 1.8 million children in 25 of the world's poorest countries. Every one of those kids are born into a family that earns less than $2 a day. Mm. And every one of those children are connected to a church in their neighborhood. And it's at that church that they get education, healthcare, proper nutrition. They get clean water to drink. They get a Bible of their very own. And they get the opportunity to hear about Jesus and have a relationship with Jesus. They don't have to. That's not a, it's not like you have to convert to Christianity in order for us to care for you and love you, but you have that opportunity to get the spiritual care you need, not just the physical care you need. So that's what Compassion does. And so I go out and ask people to become a sponsor. So in the US, you pay $38 a month to pay for the care that that child receives. But more than that, to write them letters and pray for them and build a relationship with them.
So it's such that's a unique job that you have. Have you ever thought about that? I mean, who else has a job like you?
Right. It's really strange. And now I'm kind of transitioned into trying to train other people how to do it, how to tell stories for Compassion. And you know, for a few years, Christine, I ended up running a thing called Compassion Bloggers, which was taking people like you who have influence online overseas to see the work Compassion does. So I've gotten to meet so many amazing people, authors and speakers and bloggers, and to show Compassion's work to them. So it comes full circle. You know, somebody showed me and it changed me. And so I sometimes get to take other people overseas and see them be changed by it. That's probably my favorite thing is to take someone who's never seen before and to take them to see it, or on a stage to help people who will never get to go see it, help them to see it by telling a good story.
Mm-hmm. I got to hear you once, and you're so good at what you do. So good.
Well, I appreciate that.
Well, you said earlier it changed your worldview, just going that one time to El Salvador. And now you've been to so many countries, and you've been all over North America speaking to people. So you've seen all points of the world. You've seen the most impoverished places. You've seen places that are the opposite of impoverished, and they have money to give. And I'm wondering, from that vantage point, you get to see a lot of things that we don't get to see. So how... what are kind of the big picture things you're seeing of what God is doing, or things that you wish that everyone could see and everyone could know?
The first thing that comes to mind is and we've all heard people who go overseas and they come back and they say, I was amazed by the joy that these people have. That's true, that there's incredible joy in, even in the midst of hardship and struggle right now, there's tremendous joy that comes from knowing that right now isn't the end of the story, and that you have a relationship with God, and that there is a life beyond this life and beyond the struggle, and that God sees you even in your struggle, and that he's with you. There's just tremendous joy. And I think beyond that, once I began to go on more and more trips and see more and more, I just got to see how rich the poor really are, that people who are born into poverty, poverty's not born into them, that they still are capable of incredible wisdom and insight. It goes beyond joy in the midst of struggle, but they really have a lot to teach me. And so I think when I went on a mission trip as a teenager, or when I went on my very first trip with Compassion, I saw myself as the one who had something to give, and that they are the ones who really were in need. And now I when I go on those trips, I really go with more of the posture of saying, what do I really need? What is God going to do to me and in me through these people? And I've experienced that over and over and over again all over the world, that the people we consider poor are actually very rich. There are certain aspects of God that you can't experience from a place of power and wealth and security, that you can from a place of vulnerability and poverty and struggle. I can know that God is my sustainer and my father and my protector, but I don't know that I really experienced that if I've only known health, if I've always had a credit card in my back pocket, if I've never had to really pray for daily bread because the cupboard is empty. And so these people have experienced not just a different kind of life than we have, but they've been able, because of that, to experience God very differently than we have. And I think that is part of why the church in Asia and Africa is growing. And the church in America is quickly ceasing to be the center of global Christianity. Is that there really is this dependence and this passion in people of faith when they're in struggle.
Do you ever, I would think being on both sides and seeing such stark contrasts of poverty and wealth, how do you not get discouraged about working to combat poverty, which Jesus said, we'll always have the poor with us. This is going to be a constant issue. How do you not grow discouraged in that? And then on the other side, how do you not grow cynical when you're in the North American church trying to get people to care about something that a lot of people really don't want to hear about?
Wow. Well, I do. So I have had long seasons of wondering if we're making a difference, if poverty is being combated. Statistically, I can tell you when I first began speaking for Compassion in 2005, the statistic was that 30,000 children under the age of five were dying from poverty-related causes every day. 30,000 every single day. But now it's around 12,000 every day. So just 12 years later, there's been a huge progress that's been made. But numbers don't really keep me inspired.
Yeah.
I think going that's helpful to see, okay, yeah, numerically we're making a difference. But that's hard when you're in a slum and you see a million people crammed into 3 square miles of rusting corrugated metal. And not a toilet, no running water, no electricity. It's hard in when that's all you can see to think that that there's any use making this what my life's about, you know, that this is making any kind of difference. So I've definitely had those moments. And so many times it's been the people in the developing world who've been there to encourage me, to tell me it all comes down to each person telling me their story. Here's what my life was like, but then God. And, you know, hearing those stories, the last trip I took was in Kenya, and I was in the home of a young man named Boniface, and Boniface was 18, and I was there with his mom and dad, and I was just asking them, tell me your story. And they were saying there was a tremendous famine. So the dad, who was a farmer, didn't have work. They didn't have food. They were desperate. They lived in a tiny little space, smaller than the average American bathroom, little bitty place. And it was just very, very desperate. And Boniface was 3 or 4 years old, and he was starving to death. And he was beginning to have seizures. There was no money for health care. It was just a hopeless situation. But she said, but my neighbor told me that the church was giving out chances.
Oh, wow.
And that was just really powerful, just to hear that. I can never end poverty entirely, but the church is called to give out chances.
Yeah.
And if I can give out a chance to Boniface, and then next week I can give out a chance to his neighbor, and they can grow up and they can give a chance to their kids and to their neighbors, then it has this ripple effect. So when Jesus said, the poor you always have with you, he's referring to Deuteronomy, a passage in Deuteronomy 15. And he's assuming that his Jewish listeners are going to understand all of Deuteronomy 15. And in Deuteronomy 15, he says, the poor you're always going to have with you in the land. Therefore, I command you, open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy and to the poor. Keep giving out chances. It's not a throw up your hands and quit because the problem is too big. It's the problem is always going to be there. So you get to keep giving out chances. You get to keep showing people how good God is. You keep getting to be there for your neighbor. And so for me, it's just carrying around those stories in my head and remembering that the overall story of history is not done yet.
Yeah.
And that we have to keep doing what God's called us to do.
And I think everybody in their work, no matter what it is, if they're doing gospel work, they're parenting, they're ministering to their neighbor, they're creating a sermon for Sunday, whatever it is. Sometimes I think everybody wonders, does it matter what I'm doing? Am I doing anything that is producing any sort of change in this world? And And I think that's very encouraging for me to hear what you're saying. It's just, I'm called to do it, proclaim the gospel in certain ways, and you're proclaiming the gospel in certain ways. And we have to trust that God is using that to give someone a chance. I love that story.
I'm at so many women's events, and I hear so many women struggling with, am I doing enough? Am I doing it well enough?
Yeah. For sure.
And I think that's a real struggle. And as I see my wife do the 10,000th load of laundry and tell our kids for the millionth time, please don't leave your wet towel on the floor. And I know that she has those days where she feels like, is what I'm doing significant?
Yeah.
And is it really making a dent in a world that's so full of problems? But she's giving a chance. I just find that the women in my life struggle with this the most, feeling that if they're not on a plane to the other side of the world, they're not doing mission work. But I can't think of a greater mission work than what my mom did for me in teaching, modeling for me patience and prayer. And she was giving me a chance every day to see what God was like and to then grow up and be a person who wants to give that chance to other people. It's incredibly significant. There's no small work.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you mentioned that it is hard for you, that you do get discouraged. And are there times where you have even doubted that God is moving, that he exists, that he's there as you've walked in these countries?
No, you know, it's really, one of the great surprises of doing this work is that I struggled more coming home. That I love my wife, I love my kids, my church, my friends, my community. It wasn't that. I was, that was a sweet part of coming home. But the bitter part was that for me, God came to have a third world address, that I had an easier time seeing God's power and what God was doing in the world where there was desperate need, because the contrast was so great.
Yeah.
Right. So you go into a slum and you see that people who have nothing, they have no hope, they have nothing materially. They have no relationship with God, but then you go into a home that is connected to a church that's been changed by the gospel. They have enough to eat. They have clean water. They have shoes on their feet. They're educated and they love Jesus and they're so full of joy. And so this contrast was always there. But here in the U.S., I live in the buckle of the Bible Belt. That contrast doesn't exist. Like, even my neighbors who don't go to church, and they would still culturally have a lot of Christianity. You know, they're nice people. They're not shirtless and foodless and hopeless and on the outside.
Right.
they don't lead with their need. I don't see, it's not written on their face. It's not, you have to go deeper to see that here. And so I got a little addicted to the instant gratification of being in the developing world and seeing the stark contrast of, wow, you give someone Jesus and look how it changes everything so radically.
Yeah.
Or look, hey, you just give a little bit of generosity and it totally changes their future. And here in the U.S., you don't get such instant results. You don't get the big stark contrast. And so that was hard for me. And it's something I had to work through a bit with a counselor, that I would find myself getting angry. Mm-hmm. and you know, good Christians aren't supposed to be angry. And if you are, you should keep it to yourself. And so I really struggled with that, of coming home and feeling like, where is God here?
Yeah.
I sat down and I read my Bible, and it was so different here than it was in the Philippines. I went outside today and I didn't see Jesus anywhere. But when I was just in Ethiopia, I saw him everywhere that I went. So I struggled with that. I have had to really work through that, to see God in, to see the little things here that are actually really big things. Mm-hmm. So that continues to be a hard thing for me.
I'm wondering, I was thinking earlier when we were talking about how you ended up in this role, I kind of have wondered if, because of how you're made, I mean, obviously God designed you a certain way and he's put you in this role, but even you've always been a more sensitive, compassionate person, and even prone to melancholy, and you've written about struggle with depression. And mm-hmm. I wonder if even some of that is what God has used in this role.
Yeah, I was in an 11-year-old's home in Kolkata, India. Her name was Kiran. And something she said, she is a child who's served by compassion and tiny little home full of joy. And I remember her saying, "I'm just so very happy." Like she was bursting. She couldn't find the words in English to express how happy she was. And it just struck me, like, how on earth, like you literally have lepers camped outside your door. your streets are, there are little streams of urine that spill out of people's homes and crisscross your street that you have to walk through every day to get to school. Like I see you have a roof and you've got clothes and you get to go. I get all that, but there's so much darkness around you. How are you so happy that you're about to burst? And so I asked her, like, just teach me that. Like, what is that? What is it? And she said, "I'm so happy because I have God." And she kind of had this exasperated look on her face, like, duh, you know? And I prayed that day outside Kiran's home. God, I want that.
Yeah.
And what she explained was that because she had nothing else, that having God meant more to her maybe than it meant to me. And I came home from that trip and I immediately spoke at this very large, wealthy church. And I told them Kiran's story and I asked them to sponsor children, and very few did. And I became very angry and I went into depression. And it was the first major depressive episode I've had in my life. I didn't know it because I was never diagnosed with it, but I had probably every 2 or 3 years, a week or two where that would happen, but not that severe. So like 6th grade, 10th grade, my freshman year of college, I would have these seasons of melancholy that last a week or two. But this was the first time where it was so dark. I had no faith. I had no hope. It was like all the sorrow and despair in the whole world was being funneled into my chest. I had physical symptoms. My bones ached. I felt like I had a 2-year-old wrapped around each ankle. My legs were heavy. I couldn't read anything. I couldn't read the Bible. I couldn't make sense of it. I couldn't hold a conversation. Didn't want to get out of bed. It was really, I thought I was dying. And I realized one morning, weeping in the shower, that I had this one moment of clarity, which is so rare in depression, but I had this one moment of clarity going, I'm getting to experience total dependence on God. I have nothing, and God is all that I have left. And I'm not saying that God did that to me in answer to my prayer outside Kiran's house, but I realize now that depression became a gift. That I got to experience total poverty here in the first world, that all I had was God. And I've been able to then, I haven't had a depressive episode for 7 years. And so in all those years, I get to remember that and carry that with me every day. Truly knowing that I'm dependent upon God for every breath and for every thought, for the capacity to feel pleasure, the ability to love and feel loved, the ability to think straight, that all of that is a gift. Yeah. And I think that that's something that the poor are born into, that they know that everything they have is a gift and they're truly grateful and overjoyed by it. And so for me, I had to go to the deepest low so that now I can have a much greater joy every day, that I really don't take anything for granted. I'm a very grateful and much more joyful person having been in total despair.
So you don't fear falling back into those depths, or are there certain things that you do to combat that?
I don't, you know, there are many kinds of depression. I wish that the smart people out there study it would give them all names. You know, mine, it, there are people who are depressed every day for many years and they're functionally depressed. That's not me. Mine has been kept at, when I have it, it's completely crippling, debilitating. And I'm really just, I'm completely incapacitated. And so thankfully, like I said, that hasn't happened to me in 7 years. And I do a lot of things to try to keep that at bay. I saw a therapist when I came out of that to just get some practical, well, to get a professional's input on, is there something that I haven't dealt with in my past? Yeah. Is there something I'm doing that's unhealthy in how I think? And just to, like, I just didn't want to leave any stone unturned. Like, I don't want to go back into that dark place ever again. So help me figure that out. And part of it, I don't have any trauma. I was never abused. There was no cause there. There wasn't anything I hadn't dealt with properly along the way. But I am always in a situation where I'm dealing with rejection. I ask people to give and maybe they will, maybe they won't. So I had to figure out, okay, how do I deal with that?
Yeah.
So I actually have a little prayer that I pray every time before I speak and after I speak, that God give me compassion for the big and the rich that you've given me for the small and the poor, that I need God to make me compassionate toward them, that they have a kind of poverty, that the richest have a kind of poverty. They don't realize what they have, and they maybe are lacking generosity and lacking gratitude. So God, make me compassionate toward that. I want to meet their need. So it's just changing the way that I think about them. Mm-hmm. So I don't walk away angry, but I walk away truly compassionate.
Yeah.
If they don't decide not to give, I kind of feel sorry for them that they missed out. And that's a big shift. But then it's, you know, diet and nutrition and getting proper sleep, which is hard in my line of work, and having good relationships. I set aside a day every week where I go have breakfast, lunch, and coffee with friends just so I have FaceTime. I have a true Sabbath.
Yeah.
I don't want to bore you or the people listening, but there are just a lot of things. Like, I don't look at depression as a purely spiritual thing or a purely physical thing. It's everything.
Yeah.
And so I try to prevent it on every front that I can.
I would imagine there are people listening who, when you said you have learned to see this as a gift,
yeah,
there's a lot of people who aren't there with whatever they're dealing with, whether it's anxiety or depression or just a circumstance in their life. Is there a certain truth that you go back to that really, or maybe a time where you realize, or that changed your perspective to seeing it as a gift? I guess you mentioned that time in the shower when you realized that's all you had, God.
Yeah, I think just remembering, for me in that moment in the shower, remembering Kieran's testimony that because God was all she had, he meant more to her. And that if she could look around at a neighborhood full of leprosy and filth and despair and say, you know, I'm grateful for this because it makes the light that much brighter. It makes my faith that much more important to me. It makes God's love for me that much more astonishing. It makes every crumb of provision I get today such a gift that I get to savor and give thanks for. It was just really remembering her that did it for me. And one of the things that gets me through when I'm in a depressive state too, Becky, my wife, I couldn't read scripture. So sometimes she would read it to me, or she would write down verses for me and she would make me read them. Even if it would take me a long time, like I sounded like a kindergartner learning to read. I couldn't get my brain to work. And one of those is Psalm 42, which is very familiar to people, but, you know, because it's that as the deer pants for streams of water, my soul pants for you, God. So it's that desire when we're familiar with that. But then he says, my tears have been my food day and night. And that people are saying, where is your God? I definitely had those lies in my head. Yeah. I had horrible nightmares where my faith would be attacked. And I just really felt like maybe there is no God. But then he said, these things I remember as I pour out my soul And that word pour out is like when you pour out the blood of an animal when it's slaughtered. And that's what it feels like to be in the deepest depths. You feel like you are just bleeding out. But he says, this is what I remember when that's happening. I remember how I used to go with all the people into the house of God and worship. And so for me, in the midst of that despair, I would try to remember that this hasn't always been what my life is. Yeah. And this won't always be what my life is. And that's very hard for a depressed person. But for me in depression, it's like being in a very small black box, and I can't see the past very well, and I can't see the future. And I think that this is all that exists. And so for me, taking David's example and really, really fighting to remember who I used to be, looking at a photo album, I used to smile and trying to remember what that was like, what it felt like to hug my kids and to feel loved, what it felt like to eat food and really be able to taste it, what it felt like to lead other people in worship or to sing a song and get lost in it.
Yeah.
I had to really fight to remember.
Yeah.
So Wes Stafford, who was at the time was the president of Compassion International, when I went through all that, he struggled with depression as well. And he called me one day and said, you know, I heard you're in it. Let's pray together. He prayed with me. Then he said that when he was in depression as a missionary in Haiti many years ago, that someone had told him, remember in the darkness what you believed in the light. And I wrote that down. And every day as I would sit and cry, I would say, God, help me remember. Yeah. I don't even know if you're there anymore, but help me remember when I used to believe you were there. Yeah. When I was so sure you were there that I would run through a wall for you. I would do anything for you. Help me remember what that was like. I can't feel it right now, but help me remember when I used to feel it. And that really did get me through. And I can say that on coming out of it, it's given me a much greater capacity to have compassion with people.
Sure.
One of the side, I don't know if this is normal, Christine. I mean, you have the education in psychology. I don't, but for me, depression has, one of the side effects is that my emotions live very close to the surface. So I've been given the nickname in my church, the crying pastor, because I don't think I've ever preached without crying. And I hate that. Like as a guy, I really don't like being emotional.
Yeah.
But I also see it as a gift that when someone is sharing with me their hurt or their story, I end up just crying.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize what a gift that is to people to be able to connect emotionally. And I didn't have that capacity before. Mm. I cared about people, but I don't think I really was able to show that.
Yeah, yeah.
And now I can't help but show it.
Yeah.
And so it really is a gift.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me think of 2 Corinthians 1, that you've been comforted. And so you comfort others. And I think there's something so beautiful about someone who has walked through a hard thing and you know it, and they're still walking forward. They're still walking forward by faith. And they're living that in front of you. I just hearing your story now, I knew some of that, and I've read what you've written about it. But it's an encouragement to my faith to go, we all have these hard things, and mine's different than that. But we all have them. And sometimes in the Christian world, we don't acknowledge that. We struggle to acknowledge that there's pain that can't be fixed.
Yeah. And you know, that was probably the greatest threat to my life. Was that I'm trying to put this in the most gracious way that I can. I'm gonna have to think about how to do it. bad things grow in the dark.
Yes.
And we have a culture, and maybe it's just me. Maybe it's the churches I've just been in and the friends I've had, but I've somehow gotten the message throughout my life that you don't share your struggles. I was on staff at a church once as a college pastor, and I was mentored by an older, wiser minister there who said, people on the boat don't want to know that the captain doesn't know where he's going. So you don't ever want to share that. You never want to share your struggle, because it takes confidence away from the people you're leading. They're not going to have confidence in you and your leadership. And so that was one blatant way. Like he actually came right out and said it, but I think in a million subtle ways, I got that same message over the years that I need to keep my junk to myself. Now, there's certainly a lack of boundaries and oversharing your struggles, and I get that as well. But for me, when depression hit, I feel like the enemy took such advantage of that in telling me what a failure I was and how my days in ministry were over, how I wasn't going to have credibility, not only with people in the audience, but in my own home, that that how could I be of any, how could I be, how could I offer any wisdom or encouragement or help to anyone else when I'm so lost?
Yeah.
And I felt so, so ashamed. And so I tried to keep it to myself. And it got worse because I kept it to myself. My father-in-law, who's a who was a pastor, died 2 years ago, took his own life. And part of what got him to that point was that when it, two things, when depression first started for him, which was probably caused by a heart problem, because depression can be caused by just something else going wrong in the body. He thought that he had something worse. He counseled people for years with depression as a pastor, but he didn't realize how bad it was. He didn't realize there were physical symptoms. He didn't realize it was more than just feeling sad, that it's often feeling nothing, that his body hurt. He didn't expect that. So there were just, he didn't know the signs. And so he called me to say, hey, tell me what depression feels like, because they're saying I have it, but I think I'm dying. So that was part of it. It delayed him getting the help he needed because he didn't recognize it. But the other thing that made his situation worse was that he didn't immediately tell people.
And he was still working as a pastor.
He was still working as a pastor. So he took some sick leave time, but he didn't immediately tell people. And I can't speak for him to say, was that shame, or was that thinking, well, no one's going to understand, or there's nothing they could do anyway. But I think, just on my conversation with him, that there probably was some of that. This isn't something his generation shares. It's something that's hard for my generation to even share when we're struggling. So I just think bad things grow in the dark. So when we're struggling, we have to find an appropriate place, an appropriate way to share that. So that we're not alone in it.
Do you think that his death has made you even more adamant about that?
It has, but here's the bad part of that, Christina. As I'm just being really honest with you, that I'm also afraid to tell people because Christians are so bad at listening. So. And I was, before this happened to me, I was terrible, because as a guy, I felt like, okay, so I need to fix this.
Yes.
Like I need to whip out a verse or a platitude, or, man, it was so terrible for me when I finally got so desperate that I didn't really care what people thought about me. And I would tell people, I got things like telling me prescription drugs are horrible, don't take them. I got other people saying, hey, here's a pill, just take it. Yeah. I got both extremes. I got people telling me that God was preparing me for something great, which to a depressed person is a nightmare. Like, please don't prepare me for something great. Like, it's so overwhelming, right? You get, well, God's not gonna give you something you can't handle. Like, are you kidding me? So then I feel like, so I'm just not handling this. I'm supposed to be able to, and I can't. So now I'm a failure. So I just felt like people didn't really know what to do or what to say. And so, yes, I do. I'm very adamant. I've had the opportunity a few times now to speak to groups of ministers, about helping people with mental illness, but also telling them you're at a high risk for it because you're in an occupation that is emotional labor. And so you've got to know the signs and take care of yourself before it happens. Here are some things you can do. But at the same time, it makes me nervous to tell people we got to have a conversation about mental illness, because people sometimes say hurtful, dumb things.
Well, I think there's this idea that if you can just find that solution, it's like this trajectory of health and growth that you're never going to wrestle with it again. If you can just find that answer or say the right, if I can just say the right thing to you in this moment that we can fix it, we have a hard time just sitting with pain.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I tell you, the my best friend in the world is my brother-in-law, Brian. And when I went through depression, he did the best thing.
Well, yeah, tell us what he did.
He came over to my house and he just sat. And really, he was there so that I wouldn't hurt myself. My wife needed a break. Becky went out and had lunch with friends and she did her own thing. And he said, look, I'm just going to sit here at your house and work. And if you want to talk, I'm here to talk. If you want to just sit by me, you can come sit by me. If you need anything, let me know. I'm just here. And so I just sat on the couch about 10 feet away from him and he clacked away on his keyboard and did his thing. But I cannot even put into words. It was this weird, I just had this real sense of calm and peace that I just wasn't alone. Hmm. And that if thoughts of wanting to hurt myself were to show up, I was safe.
Yeah.
I had somebody there. And if the lies that would sometimes play in my head, if the volume got turned up on that, I had someone I could process that with.
Yeah.
He was just there. And Becky was really good at whenever I was thinking a bunch of confusing thoughts or lies, I could just say them out loud. And I knew she wasn't going to think I was a terrible person. Yeah. She knew that wasn't who I always was. And that she would just listen. And then she would say, okay, that's not true. And here's what's true. And she would tell me.
Yeah.
I really felt like the most compassionate thing, the most loving thing I could do is to take myself out of her life. That it would be better that I was holding her back and holding her down, and that her life would be so much better and more complete without me in it. And that's completely illogical, and I can't believe I ever thought that, but depression's not logical.
Right.
So I legitimately believed that with all my being. And so I could say that to her and to have her hold my face and look me in the eye and say, I'd rather have you broken than not have you at all. And that was it. She didn't like just to tell me the truth whenever I said something that was a lie and to love me in spite of that was really the best thing she could do.
Well, Sean, I really appreciate your willingness to talk so openly about really difficult things. I love that. I've learned so much just from talking to you today, and I know people listening have. And I just want to close with one question, just where you are in life now and all these things that we've talked about that you've experienced, that you've seen. What keeps you moving forward by faith, believing that God is going to redeem all of these things one day?
On my hardest days in my work with compassion, I go back to Revelation, to that amazing picture of the throne of God and a great multitude larger than anybody can count. And there's every tribe and every language and every color of skin. And we're all there together. And all the tears are gone, and all the brokenness is made whole, and we're all together. That's what I have to go back to. That is where all this is heading, and that I have a role to play in that. And so that's what really keeps me going. That's where it's all going.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time and for your openness and just for what you're doing. You're changing the world. You truly are with what you're doing.
Well, I think we all are in our own way. You know, we all have a part to play in that, in God reconciling all things. I was on a trip in Tanzania many years ago with a group of female bloggers, and one of them was just heartbroken by something we had seen. And she just said, I just don't know how you do this over and over again. I just don't see progress. That house we just visited, I just don't see that they're making a lot of progress. And we just talked about how slow hope is. Mm. Hope is slow, but it's still coming. Yeah. It's slow, but it's still there. I think in our kind of fast food, instant gratification, world, it's hard to be to live at God's pace. That God moves sometimes much more slowly than I would like, but we all know where it's headed, and we all have our part to play. It might not be as big a part as we would like it to be, but we're all playing a part in that.
I know y'all are wondering what my prom dress looked like, the one I described as looking like a fish with shoulder pads. I've got the picture up on my blog, gracecoversme.com, as well as more information on compassion and how you can join Sean and join my family in helping kids and families who are entrenched in poverty. Join me next week on By Faith as the tables are turned and my sweet husband Kyle interviews me about my own personal searching for spring, why I wrote my new book, and what I've learned about living by faith. Until then, friends, have a great day and keep walking forward by faith.